Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern and I am joined by Heidi White and Tim McIntosh. Two people who are definitely not phonies, I would say. How's it going?
Oh, thanks, David.
David, thank you. Thank you.
A phony either, David. You're like for real not a phony, like ever.
Thanks. Yep. Well, we are here to discuss The Catcher in the Rye, J.D. Salinger's controversial, but also beloved and very popular novel from the 1951 was when it was published. And we are going to talk about it over the next 3 weeks, and then we're going to do the Q&A episode. Before we do that, though, I want to remind people about some of the ways that they can get in touch. If you've been listening for a long time, then you already know about our Facebook group, the Close Reads Podcast Discussion Group. Lots of discussion going on there. Peas Like a River had feels like maybe a record amount of conversation going on. People really liked talking about that book. I suspect that Catcher in the Rye is going to have plenty of similar conversation, although there might be more hate discussion going on. So if you want to either vent or celebrate this book, then you can head over there and do that. You can also find us on Instagram and on Twitter at Close Reads Pods, and you can email us at closereadspodcasts@gmail.com. And then finally, we do have our email newsletter, which you can sign up for at closereads.substack.com. And we are going to have a new edition of that going out today. So by the time you have heard this episode, that will be in your mailboxes, but you can sign up for that and see the archives on that. It'll be a mailbox edition. And then a little bit of extra content about this book and about why people love it and some links to some critical essays and things like that. So if you're interested, you can head over to closereads.substack.com if you're not already signed up for that. Guess I should also mention the Patreon episodes. We are this week we'll have the second episode of our Crime and Punishment conversations going up. And in my opinion, it's one of the best episodes that we've ever done together. So I hope you'll check that out. You can also support the show in addition to getting some sweet show swag. So
that like rolled right off the tongue.
Practicing.
That was awesome.
Practicing.
All done.
So there's lots of ways you can get in touch and lots of ways you can be involved, including getting the bonus content and supporting the show over on Patreon. That's patreon.com/closereads. So I want to just say, well, the reason we're doing this book is because each year we have kind of a fundraising auction to help us support the parent company and the show and all that. And last year, our power listener group, what do we want to call them? They call themselves Jocose Reads.
I like power listener.
Yeah, there are.
I like that too.
All right, so that's what we'll call them. There are, you know, longtime supporters of the show, and they got together and they bidded collectively on an auction item, which was the opportunity or the chance to choose a book that we read on the show. I found out recently from one of our listeners who is in that group, Jesse Brown, that they were considering doing Peace Like a River as the book they were going to choose. But then they found out that that was on my short list. So they went with Catcher in the Rye as the book that they wanted us to talk about. And I'm going to come back around to that because they sent me a list, or Jesse sent me a list of reasons why they chose it. And I want to come back around to get a sense of some of the things that motivated them to choose this book, which they know full well is a little controversial and which many people don't like. But before we do that, I want to turn to each of you and get your sort of history of this book and your experiences with it. And then before we dive in, I will provide a little bit more context for this book with some information that people might be interested in. But Tim, let me turn to you first. This is a book that is between, I think, 1961 and 1985, was the single most taught book in American schools.
Wow.
And colleges. It beats Huckleberry Finn. No other book was taught more often in schools than The Catcher in the Rye.
Wow.
During those decades. I think it's been bumped down a little bit, but it's still in the top five since the mid 80s. You were in school, at least in that range.
Yeah.
So I'd love to know if you read this in high school or maybe even middle school, and what your first impressions of it were back then.
I remember my first reading as being the summer of my junior year in college. And I may have read it before then, but I don't remember reading it before then. But I distinctly, I had kind of an event when I read this book after my junior year in college.
Go on.
Well, I was...
Like the book or the reading of it was an event, or there was an event that happened while you were reading it that makes it memorable?
I was living near a really good friend of mine, and I'm trying to be kind of opaque about this. I was living near a really good friend of mine, and he read the book. I fell in love with the book. I loved it. I mean, I just thought I got so neck deep in Holden Caulfield. I was really moved by it. I was really wrapped up in it. Mm. And I gave it to him and I recommended it, and he hated it. Mm. He hated it. He didn't understand why anybody would read it. And moving forward a few years, this is the only friend that I have ever broken up with. And it doesn't have anything to do with the book, but I mean, I think even right then.
Maybe it does.
Yeah, I was like, golly, how could he hate this book so much and I love it so much and us be such good friends?
It was the moment of truth, this book.
It was the beginning of the moment of truth, yeah. At least.
It revealed that he was a phony. So how many times have you read it since that summer before your junior year of college?
I think this is my this read for Close Reads is my third.
Okay. So do you remember when the second time was?
No, I think it was probably my late 20s, early 30s, something like that.
Do you remember whether your perspective on it had changed? Did you still like it?
I still liked it. And I still like it now.
Okay. All right. Let's turn to you, Heidi. So when did you first read it? Was it a high school thing for you?
Yeah, high school. In honors English, my junior year of high school.
Ooh, you were in honors.
That's a shocking turn of events. I'll tell you what I was not in honors in. Honors math. I was in
you and Holden, right?
Right.
Both in honors English.
Hey, by the way, I just have to say something, Heidi, since you were not familiar with my brand of student when, you know, we were each in high school. Do you know what they called the lower division of English, which I was thankfully not in, but I think I was right on the cusp.
You were in the mid-tier?
I was lower to mid-tier. They called the lowest tier, you're just not going to believe it, they called it communication lab. It's like you've fallen if you were in communication lab. And I was barely keeping out of communication lab.
That's really funny. I'm sad.
As someone who didn't do well in math, I feel like that's also what they were calling my math classes. Communication lab. Introduction to logical thinking or something like that.
Right, exactly.
So they taught you math with letters.
Like, just do your best.
Yeah. It's like you were relegated.
Yes. Oh, sorted.
So did you like it in high school then, Heidi?
So I think what I'm learning is a pretty unique experience with Catcher in the Rye. Most people love this book or hate this book. And in high school, I was like, meh. About Catcher in the Rye. I remember the teacher. I had just the best teacher. And I remember her talking about some of the events that happened later in the novel and explaining the structural significance and me being like, oh, that's cool. But I did not have a strong emotional reaction one way or the other. And that's the only time I've ever read it until now. Hmm.
So you haven't read it since you haven't picked it up. You haven't.
No, thought, I mean, I thought about it.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those books. I'm like, oh, I should reread Catcher in the Rye. But I was so meh about it at the time. Like, it just didn't
make a
big impression. I remember it being funny and I remember it laughing. And then I remember it kind of taking a downward trajectory in me. You know, I remember it. I actually don't remember the ending at all. I have no memory of the end of this novel. But it just didn't make a big impression. And like I said, I've learned since that's unique. Most people have a very strong reaction one way or the other. How about you, David?
Very similar to Tim. I didn't read it in high school. I guess I just didn't go to, I guess, my Christian school. And then the one year that I was homeschooled, my dad didn't have us reading this during high school. So I read it Well, I guess it wasn't my junior. I read it the next year when I had dropped out of Bible college and was living with Graham.
Wandering the streets of New York, staying in seedy hotels.
I was wandering the streets of Dubuque, Iowa in the middle of winter, working at a very rundown A&W restaurant that I could walk to. I could actually slide down it on the snow from the front door of this very old house that we lived in. And I worked there because I didn't have a car and it was very cold and I didn't want to walk very far. So I worked there and I remember standing behind the grill reading it when it was slow. And then I would just stick it in my back pocket when I had to do something. So that was my first experience with this book.
That's a great story. That's
very Southern Gothic. Like, I feel like that would be a scene in the opening of a movie.
Yeah, I just remember, like, you know, you work at like a greasy fast food place and
Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah, fold the book up. It probably has like a little old paperback version and then stick it in my back pocket when I had to clean something or cook something. And when there was a little slow, just pull it out. And I would like to know actually where that copy of that book is, because it's probably covered in like fast food grease stains and, you know,
that is an adjective correlative to this novel. Did you like it?
Yeah, I mean, I was 19 or whatever. I think like Tim, it probably was spoke to something in 19-year-old trying to find a way in the world version of me. Now I'm just a 33-year-old version of still trying to find my way in the world. But I don't know that this book would be the one that would speak to me so much. But I read it again in my late 20s, probably, so not that long ago. But weirdly, I don't really remember it. I think I read it quickly when there was a lot of other stuff going on in my life over like a day or two. And I don't have a lot of, I didn't read it closely. So I'm interested in how close read changes my perspective on it. Because I today, the way I think about it is an interesting book that I'm a little nervous to read on the podcast.
Right.
Because a lot of people I know don't like it. And I've had, you know, I've had conversations at Circe events, at close reads type events, where people get very heated about it, either because they love it and are trying to defend it and it means something really powerful to them, really profound to them. It's very important to them. And then there's people who just don't understand why, you know, like Tim's friend, we would read such a book like this, fill our head with such things, and so forth. So
can we talk about why, sorry to cut you off, David, why people don't like it?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah, great.
So it seems to me that there are, we should see if we can just eliminate the obvious things. I mean, not eliminate them in terms of like their valid reasons for not liking this book, but they're obvious. So let's just put those out there. On the one hand, there is all the language. So a lot of people just don't want to read, you know, all the swearing. So that seems like an obvious one, which, you know, that's a perfectly valid reason. And, it is what it is.
We support that.
It's there. Yeah. So then if we get beyond that, what would you say are maybe ones that are less obvious and maybe vary from person to person? Tim, do you have, like, what did your friend say? Was it the curse words, the language?
I think he just felt like the entire subject matter was just lowbrow. Like, what are we doing here, guys? We're not, unlike our previous book, we're not trying to find a lost brother. We're not, trying to find, there's nothing. Yeah. There's nothing noble in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that, what would you say, Heidi?
Yeah. All of that. And just Holden is not very likable. He's not, you know, the nice young man that he's constantly referencing as a phony. So I think it's painful. He thinks in a very true adolescent way, like very true adolescent way. It's interesting. I'm reading this at the same time and you guys are doing the same thing, that I'm listening to All the Pretty Horses. And
yeah, like, I just finished it. Yeah.
Contrast between the two main characters in terms of their ages and our access to their inner life. Like, Holden Caulfield thinks like a real teenager, and teenagers are the worst. And so that's part of it, I think. It's painful for us.
The teenagers listening are like, what?
Well, it's, I mean, you're just, and then they're like, it's true. self-absorbed. Yes, exactly. So, and I think that's why I responded the way I did. I was thinking about this as I was reading it, and thinking as
responded
a teenager,
to it when you first
yes,
read it.
Yes, when I was 16 and reading it and thinking, well, this is just like every day in the lunchroom. Like this is, I didn't understand the access I was getting into this kind of mind because it was just like my mind. Mm. So I took it seriously. I like really took this book very, like I just accepted him as he was without any kind of judgment and in the true sense of the word judgment, any kind of thinking about the thinking, any kind of meta narrative. I didn't pick up on it at all. Mm. And I think as adults, especially as parents, we're like, oh, it's either like eye rolling or just painful sometimes. Mm. Mm.
So there is some subtlety in this book that I think we need to keep an eye on because, and one of the things that I'd love to kind of just keep front and center as we're talking about it over the next 3 or 4 episodes is the question of, given the themes and given some of the subtlety, should high schoolers be reading it?
It's a great
because
question.
That is, it's the, like I said, it was the most hot book in the 60s, 70s and 80s. And still today, it is one of the most hot books. And whether, even if we can sort of protect our kids from reading it, so to speak, protect our kids in high school because they're homeschooled or because they go to a Christian school that wouldn't read it because of the language or something. When they get to college, if they pursue a sort of life in letters, a life in English and literature and things like that, they're going to almost certainly run across it. Or at least at some point, they're probably going to pick it up for themselves. So I think that's something that we should keep front and center. Before we dive into it though, I do want to provide some context for this. And then I'm going to share what Jesse had to say. As I said, it was one of the most most taught books in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But even to this day, since its publication in 1951, to this day, 1 million copies are sold every year.
Hmm. That's incredible.
More than 65 million copies have been sold. I mean, that in book sales, that's absolutely the only word. Wow. Tim used the best word, right? Like a million books being sold in 1 year is, you know, a book becomes a bestseller if 10,000 copies are sold. So,
right. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
If you get to 100,000 copies, it's a great success. So a million copies are sold every year, not just 1 year, but every year of this book.
Wow, that's staggering. Really,
David, before we hear from Jesse, I want to just throw something else in here. One of the things that I think we should be reading for is whether or not this book is anything more than like the literature gateway drug. Because I think that's the reason that it sells so many copies is that the voice is so, as Heidi said, it's the voice of an adolescent. And I think it's great. I think its greatest merits is in its voice. Mm. And the question for me upon reading it for the third time as a grown man is, okay, is that all that it is? Is it just a way for a young person who thinks like this, who doesn't want to read literature, who wants to work on their car or chase girls, you know, they're hopefully going to identify with this. And thus the teacher thinks I'm going to get them into the reading life, hopefully. But then the question is for me, okay, so I think this book is very successful at that. Is it anything more than that? Hmm. That's kind of one of the things that I'm going to keep my eye on.
That's a good question.
So Time Magazine in 2005, they had a list of the 100 best English language novels. It was included on that. It was named on the Modern Library and its readers as one of the 100 best English language novels of the century. The Guardian had a list recently. It showed up at number 72 on that. BBC had a survey where it came up at number 15 on the best novels of the 20th century. So there are a lot of lists and a lot of readers and critics who would argue that it is more than that. Adam Gopnik for The New Yorker once said that it was one of the 3 best American novels along with Moby Dick and I think he said Moby Dick and Huckleberry Finn. So, you know, it has its defenders from that perspective.
Yeah.
So maybe we should try to, you know, as we're talking, try to get a sense of why that might be. But let's go ahead and hear from Jesse because I asked her to come on and she said she couldn't because one of her children was in dance lessons or something. So I said, okay, then you need to send me a list. Oh, no, speech class. send me a list of some of the reasons why you all chose it. And again, it wasn't just Jessie, but she kind of became the voice for the group. But this was a book that was nominated by the group of readers, the Jocose readers, who collectively bid for it in the auction. So thanks for doing that, not just because you got to choose the book, but because you really support the show and what we're doing here by bidding on that. So thank you. And so this is what Jessie said. She said, I'll just read some of these in bullet points. So Catcher in the Rye has a lot going for it, minus the swear words. That's where she started. So she did, you know, throw that as she understands that. She pointed out that it's something many of our children will one day have to read and many of them will love. So the implication is we should try to understand it. It has been accepted, as we've said here, as great literature for a long time. So we can try to figure out why. She pointed out that Graham Pittman likes it and Graham cameos are my favorite. That's what she said. Grammios, that's what we're going to call them.
Grammios.
It's also a cereal.
Perfect.
Grammios is a cereal.
No, I'm saying it should be. It's not literally a cereal.
It should be.
She says Holden Caulfield is as real as you or me, which I think is an interesting way of putting it and worth keeping front and center. She said, Holden Caulfield will break your heart while also reminding you how lovable humans are. She also said that when she was bidding it was the day before her birthday. So she threw that in there as well. And she said this wasn't in her pitch last May to the group when they chose what book to select as a group. But she said that the biggest reason that she pulled for the group to bid on Catcher in the Rye is that Holden has been her realist book friend for the longest time. And I wanted to share him with my other book friends, the close readers.
She's so great.
That's a great defense.
Yeah. So those are some things that, you know, are why the group chose it. So if you're angry at the group of people for choosing this book that you don't like, then, you know, hopefully even if you don't read, hopefully you'll listen along and try to get a sense of what else is going on in this book, or that's there who you can get angry at. You know, but as I said in the email newsletter that's going out, if you like this series and you like this book, then we were definitely the ones who chose it, and you should go review the podcast with 5 stars. So,
well done. I segue.
Let's get into the beginning of this book, because as you said, the voice is kind of its defining characteristic, and we get that right from the self-deprecating first line, which seems to be hearkening to not just Charles Dickens, which Salinger immediately references, which Holden Caulfield references by saying the David Copperfield kind of crap, but it also seems to be referencing Huckleberry Finn and his sort of line at the beginning that, you know, don't try to read too much into this. But it says, if you really want to hear about it, the first thing you'll probably want to know is where I was born and what my lousy childhood was like and how my parents were occupied and all before they had me. And all that David Copperfield kind of crap. But I don't feel like going into it if you want to know the truth. So let's talk about then what defines this voice. And Tim, you were talking about that, I think, first. So can you give a little bit of a summation of what you most identify as being the defining characteristics of this voice, and maybe what you most identify personally with in the voice of Holden Caulfield?
Well, I agree so strongly with Jessie. Like, Holden Caulfield is as real a character as I've ever read. He's so, and I don't just mean like he's real as in hashtag real talk. I mean, he's just so accurately drawn. He's the kind of character that you read him and you're like, oh man, yes, I know this guy. I know this guy. This guy was me. He was in my high school class. And then he also, there'll be certain decisions that he makes that surprise you, but they surprise you. And then when they happen, you're like, of course he's doing this. This is exactly what he would do. And I couldn't have predicted it, but I knew somehow it was going to happen. And so when I said the voice, well, I didn't see it coming, but when it happened, I knew it had to be.
Oh yeah. Right. Okay. I see. Yeah.
The way that we get to know Holden is chiefly through his self monologue. It's a little bit through what he actually says to other characters, which is great, but most of it is through just the way that he thinks about things. And the way that he thinks about things is so satisfying and infuriating at the same time. The most infuriating thing is everything is stated in terms of always being absolutes. My father never speaks to me. You know, like things like this. Ackley always is cleaning his nails when he comes into my room. You know, it just, everything is in like harsh black and white. And it's part of that, that age. And it's like one of the most infuriating things about that age. And it's also kind of like one of the most endearing things about that age. In a way. Like, I'm glad I'm not mired in it anymore, but, I just think that
my 7-year-old does that. So does that mean he's maybe when you're early onset teenager?
Yeah, it probably does.
Wait, no, he's 8 now.
Those are some of the things about the voice. And I also think the cadence of the voice kind of does two things at once. How do I say this? Holden is absolutely self-obsessed. I mean, he's just locked in his own ego. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he's also very self-effacing. I mean, you hear it in that first line, if you really want to hear about it, you know, and then he talks about his childhood is lousy. So everything is of great importance. And it's also, he's very condescending to himself about his story. And it hits both those notes back and forth throughout the entire novel.
It feels like he doesn't think much of himself, and yet he also sees himself as like this hero in some kind of epic, or he desperately wants to be the hero in a kind of epic, and yet doesn't think he's really the right person for it. You know, and you mentioned this inner monologue. Can you define that a little bit? Like, I mean, you were giving some examples of things you like. I really like what you said about how he's using these extreme language, and that's one of the defining characteristics of his voice. Can you be a little more specific in what you mean by the inner monologue? Are you talking about a sort of stream of consciousness thing, or is there something, is there an actual term you're using there that has, you know, capital I, capital M that you'd like to define?
Well, when he's having conversation with anybody, let's say Ackley, when Ackley comes into his dorm room, Holden will say something in reply to Ackley. He'll say, I know that Ackley sport. And then there'll come a long kind of descriptive inner monologue about what he thinks about how much Ackley hates being called Ackley sport.
Yeah, right.
Well, thanks so much, Ackley sport. You're a prince. Ackley hated it when I called him sport. He hated it because this and this reason, and he was always doing this and this and this. I appreciate it, Ackley sport. You're a prince. And so it's a little bit what Holden says that's funny, but it's partly that this talk, it's so, I don't know how to describe it.
Theatrical?
It drives everything forward. It's very theatrical. It drives everything forward. Everything's in black and white.
Mm. So Heidi, you've been reading it again for the first time. I hadn't read it in a long time and you were meh about it when you first read it. So does the voice, do the characteristics of the voice that appeal to Tim stand out to you this time?
Yes, absolutely. I noticed the same thing. I mean, it's a very informal conversation. It reads kind of like a really long Facebook status, or you know what it sounds like? It really does sound like a therapy session. This is exactly what a therapy session, if you're curious about therapy sessions, this is what they're like. Someone just starts talking about themselves and they talk in their own voice. So it's very informal. And then jump from topic to topic. And it's, if you're in the therapist chair, you're making these connections for them. You're like, okay, so you're telling me you're not going to do all the David Copperfield kind of crap. And then you immediately start talking about your childhood. Interesting. Let's talk about that. Right. Like, so, that very self-revelatory tone, but the person thinks they're managing the tone, but they're not. Like, they're revealing themselves all the time, but they think that they have kind of managed your impression. And I love, I really liked that about the book this time.
I was thinking about how it does kind of have we talked about this with Peace Like a River, how it has like an oral like it seems like they're telling us, just telling the story as opposed to writing it. And that definitely shows up here. Like and I think it shows up in the there's not much of a difference between the way he talks to people and the way he talks to himself. Like the syntax, the language, the formality of it is sort of all is very similar in terms of the nature of the language itself. So there's, you know, sometimes you'll get a narration and the point of view of that narration is very formal and very buttoned up and put together and very literary in a sense. And then the dialogue will be different. But here the dialogue, the way he talks to his friends is the way he's talking to us. You know, it's not really any different.
Right. Well, it's so well structured to your point. Like it's like tight as a drum. It's brilliant. But it does sound very, I mean, that's J.D. Salinger, right? What an author. This is incredible. And so I think to go back to the reason why it sells so well, even if you don't know that you recognize how well written something is, you respond to a very well written narrative. So I think that's part of the appeal, is that it's just so tightly structured along, but it feels very informal, like you're just having a conversation or listening to somebody talk about themselves. And it's also really funny. And I do not talk like this. Like I do not use all this profanity, but it's funny. Like it's really great. Like it's super humorous. And if you took out all of the swear words, it would not be as funny. It would be as good, but it wouldn't be as funny. So
okay. Let's talk about this. I feel like we should just do this. We should just have a conversation about it.
Take the bull by the horns.
Yeah. I mean, people, obviously there's a lot of people who are going to be put off by that. And that's a perfectly valid reading. So what I want to ask first is why does Salinger have it so front and center? And then what is the effect of it? So you're saying that it wouldn't be as funny, so that there's a humorous aspect of that. And I feel like a lot of people will just reject the notion that the cursing can be humorous outright.
I know.
So,
and that's fair.
So can you talk about like what do you think is the sort of dramatic effect of and purpose of all this language? Because, you know, after a while you start realizing, you know, it's one thing for this kid to talk like that sometimes, and then it's just a habit. But there's a difference between something being a habit, and in this case maybe a bad habit, and something being a purposeful.
Right.
Like he is curating or cultivating a character in himself, and the language is part of that. Like he thinks that he has to talk or this way or express himself this way because that's what the kind of person he's trying to be does. So it goes beyond just like it's a bad habit into like he's actively making the choice to do that. And in the same way, Salinger is making an active choice to have this much, you know, of the language there, particularly the GD phrase. Mm-hmm. So we'll just not, even when we're reading, we'll just say
GD. Yeah, absolutely.
On the show, just for obvious reasons. But So that's my question. How do you take that? How do you respond to that?
Well, it's part of Holden Caulfield. I think it does add to the humor, but I also see if it's distracting, it's then
disorienting.
Like you said, it's disorienting, or if it even is like tempting or puts bad thoughts in your head, you know, like all those things, or you don't want your kids exposed to it, all those things are perfectly valid. I'm not defending the cursing, but yeah, it absolutely adds to the atmosphere of the novel with some dark humor. And then also it adds a pathos to what could be interpreted as lighthearted talking. Like it lets you know there's something troubled in this boy. And
so it makes what seems like it could be lighthearted serious.
It does, but it also makes it funny. So it does, again, serves a literary purpose in the novel. It does both things. It's used both ways. And that is skill. Whether or not it's moral, it's skilled.
Yeah, yeah. Tim, do you take the sort of persistence of his, you know, his commitment to this sort of way of speaking to be humorous?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think it's accurate. Like, I believe these Pensy boys talk this way. Now, I think it'd be a fun question to ask, why do they talk this way? Mm-hmm. You know, like, is every kid in 1945 talking this way? No, there's something about this kind of demographic of young boy that's talking this way. I suspect that like farm boys from Iowa in 1945 are not speaking this way.
Yeah, by the way, were very, they were doing something similar, but in a different way.
Maybe so. But I mean, my suspicion is that farm boys in Iowa who are still on the farm and not at this elite boarding school in New York had probably enough. They were probably living in adult cultures enough that speaking that way was just not going to be accepted. Whereas this little petri dish of adolescence that's kind of growing in the dorm of this school tolerates that. There's not so much, the adults are just not around that much. And so it gives a certain freedom that these boys exploit. And I think it's accurate. I believe that this is the way that those boys talk.
Yeah.
And so I think it's funny. And I also think he's not larding up the narrative with curse words to somehow be sensational. I think this is like part of the journalistic aspect of being a novelist.
Mm. I was thinking about how Salinger he fought in World War II. He had written some of this beforehand, and then he wrote more of it afterwards, I believe, in terms of sort of crafting it into a finished novel in the late 40s. And so a lot of people talk about how it, in some ways, Holden Caulfield's journey mirrors what a journey might be for a soldier who was on leave.
Wow.
I think he fought the Battle of the Bulge. And so he was in some serious, you know, combat, or at least adjacent to it. I don't know. I don't want to say too much about that, 'cause I don't know how much fighting he was involved in, but enough for it to be somewhat traumatic. And so I imagine it in some ways being like, you know how when soldiers are together and they're in combat, there's certain ways of life and speaking and coping and all these things that manifest themselves, and like they become part of the community. It's the same thing with a team of athletes.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with teenage girls. It's the same thing with adult women and adult men. And, you know, every group of community of people, every community of people sort of begins to speak in its own sort of way. It communicates the sort of ethos of the group. And these young men in this school, you mentioned that perhaps this sort of way of talking would fester and present itself among these guys. And it feels very performative. Like,
yeah, like it does.
Like they speak that to speak that way is sort of to stand up for yourself. To speak that way is its own sort of violence, right? Like you know how when the kid finally punches him or he kind of, it's not Ackley, it's the other, it's
Stadlatter.
Yeah. Stadlatter. Yeah. So eventually he kind of attacks Stadlatter, and then Stadlatter dominates him, right? And up to that point, the violence up to that point has been building and building and building in the way they speak to each other. And that's such an accurate thing among young men, I think, where these guys are constantly jostling for position and for, you know, sort of like to be the...
Who's going to be the alpha?
Exactly. And then eventually, you know, the language, the way you speak to each other is what is your, you know, your jab. You know, every time you say one of those words or you call him something or you accuse him of something, it's like a jab. It's a jab and a jab and a jab, and it's a body blow. And you're throwing them back and forth until eventually the only option you have is to actually fight the person. And so the language, I think, is each little time they say that, it's a sort of attempt to gain the upper hand over the other person. And those sorts of communities, I think, have a way of the artificiality of them, I think, and the artificiality that they promote can have a way of producing that sort of, like the necessity for that sort of interaction between young men. I'm sure that something similar happens with young women in an all girls school, but and I also was never a young woman, so I don't know. But this rings so true in terms of the way young men who are trying to make their way in the world and also make the way amongst each other would communicate with each other. Hmm. And I don't like not every group of young men gets together and says, you know, these particular words. Young men are always doing something like this.
Right. Yeah. The tone of it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. I, that point that you brought up, David, that at this age, I mean, and maybe even into adulthood also, there's this kind of constant evaluation and assertion of where you are in the hierarchy.
Yeah.
And when friendships form, that hierarchy usually is pretty fixed. You know, like when I was with my friends, there were certain groups I was the alpha, and there were other groups where I wasn't the alpha. But when the groups were forming, there was always this sort of negotiation, or this time of negotiation with my male friends, like, okay, who's the leader here and who are the followers and who gets to dictate the terms and who gets to listen to the terms? All those things were sort of negotiated. And the negotiations as a 16-year-old, they can be pretty brutal. They can be really, really rough because we're boys. We haven't learned kind of like these finer skills, these more graceful skills of like settling those sorts of disputes with any sort of grace. So,
yeah.
And what I think is really interesting about these opening, especially after we meet Mr. Spencer.
Yeah, I want to bring that up. I want to talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. I want to talk about that also. Like, that's basically the opening of the book and why is it the case. So,
well, you mentioned hierarchies because that comes up in this conversation that he has, because he keeps saying to Spencer, it says on page 17, at least in the version that I have, they're talking about his paper, right? Spencer's kind of going through his paper and he just reads the part where Holden wrote to him, "Dear Mr. Spencer, this is all I know about the Egyptians," and so forth. And then he puts the paper down, and then Spencer asks him, "Do you blame me for flunking you, boy?" he said. And then he says, "No, sir, I certainly don't," I said. "I wished he'd stop calling me boy all the time." And so the sort of question of condescension and hierarchy comes up right away here at the beginning. And then it comes throughout this whole section, because then he calls, as Heidi pointed out earlier, he's calling the other guy boy, Ackley boy. So he's calling Ackley exactly what he hates being called. Everybody is constantly, trying to sort of figure out not just where they are in the hierarchy, but avoid being beneath somebody else in the hierarchy. That's the more important thing. It doesn't matter so much who you're over, but it matters who you're under a lot.
And when we meet Stradlatter, he's so clearly Holden can't stand him, but he's very clearly, he's built really well. He's good looking. He's good with the girls, which is something that every young man wishes he had the capacity for. But every young man, now I'm speaking categoricals. I was always thinking, golly, I'm so bad at this. I don't know what to say. I just am so awkward. But Stradlatter somehow has this kind of magical capacity.
And then you became a writer.
And Stradlatter, I think what's important about Stradlatter is that Holden sees that his ability with the girls is because it's not authentic. And Holden, we kind of learn a little bit later in the story, Holden kind of has this kind of compass that he's not going to talk to girls. He's not going to try to like make out with girls if he's not genuinely interested in them. And this is what one of the things that he can't stand about Stradlatter is that Stradlatter doesn't care at all. And
he doesn't
gets
care about the girl as a person.
So this theme that's going to emerge very loudly as the book continues to go on, maybe I'm jumping the gun a little bit, of Holden's attempt in this ill-formed, stumbling way to be authentic in some way is already kind of showing itself in his relationship with who is the top dog, Stradlatter. Mm.
Hey, Heidi, I have a question for you. And I want to get to that in a second, but I want to take a break here because I want to tell everyone about some friends of ours who have a pretty cool program. So there's this thing called onlinegreatbooks.com. So what they're trying to do is help people develop a habit of reading classic books. So they have books like those by Homer, Cicero, Spinoza. I mean, you could read Nietzsche if you wanted. So you go to onlinegreatbooks.com, and it's designed to help you develop that regular habit of reading. So there's weekly reading goals, there's reminders, there's accountability tools. There's a dedicated community, not unlike probably what you have here with Close Reads, that can help keep you on track and schedule with your reading. They have check-ins and reading goals, like in a system that's designed to help you progress through the great books, where you just have to read for 1 hour each week, three times. So 3 one-hour reading sessions each week, if you can make sense of the math that I just tried to produce there. And every month, what they're going to do is they're going to send you a carefully selected edition of one of those great books directly to your home. So you don't have to worry about ordering or anything like that. Now, I know sometimes we like to curate that, but also sometimes when you're trying to keep the habit, you know, having some help like this can be helpful. So they begin with Homer, and then they're going to progress through Plato and Aristotle, you know, Descartes, Shakespeare, and on through the moderns. And then they also have a bunch of resources to go along with that. So they have 2-hour video conferences to discuss the text. There's Socratic seminars led by trained Socratic hosts. And what you can do if you want to participate in this, if you're interested in joining, then you can go to onlinegreatbooks.com to join their list and receive an executive book summary, which is a digest of all their reading lists and more. So it seems like something that'd be right up the alley of all our Close Reads listeners. Even if you are not ready to actually sign up for the whole thing, go get on their mailing list, because they have lots of great resources and research and blog posts and things that they send out that are interesting to people who just love books. So even if you're not ready to join the full program, you can do that. But if you want to join the program, you can head over to onlinegreatbooks.com and then enter the code CIRCE, and they'll give you 25% off your first 3 months. Or you can go to onlinegreatbooks.com/CIRCE and you can get 25% off there as well. So this is it's a cool program. You may have heard about them on podcasts like The Art of Manliness, if you or the men in your family listen to that podcast. So again, that's onlinegreatbooks.com/CIRCE, or you can go to onlinegreatbooks.com and enter the code CIRCE to get 25% off. Like I said, it's a pretty cool program, and it seems, you know, right up the alley of our loads of you who are listening and participating in the Close Reads community. Okay, Heidi, I gotta ask you a question now.
Proceed.
You have 2 kids.
Right.
I do.
How old are your kids again?
13 and 10.
Okay. So let's imagine that your kids are a few years older, I guess, for the sake of this conversation. I imagine that you imagine that all the time anyway. You're constantly thinking about it, probably.
True.
Time passing such as it does and so forth.
Indeed.
What would you tell your kids? What would you tell Jack and Lucy if they either were friends with Holden Caulfield or wanted to be friends with Holden Caulfield?
That's a great question. A really, really good question. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about Holden Caulfield to me in reading it this time is that I have absolutely no idea what Holden Caulfield would be like if I just met him. Because he admittedly lies often, and we see from the very beginning tells people what they want to hear,
yeah,
in order to deflect attention or whatever it is from his true and very troubled self. And maybe that's a human thing. Maybe that's an adolescent thing. Maybe that's just Holden, but it's not. That's, you know. And so I think if I met Holden, I would probably think he was a delightful young man who should be friends with my son.
Much like the woman in chapter 8.
Yep. You know, and I have to admit, I'm a sucker for this kind of, you know, I have my 13-year-old has friends over, and if they come into the kitchen, "Hello, Mrs. White. Thank you for the snacks. Thanks for having me over." My mom says, "Hi."
What's the kid from Leave It to Beaver that everyone,
yes,
Eddie
yeah, right, Eddie Haskell. Yes, Eddie Haskell. Like, I am like, what a nice young person. Like, so that's,
there are so few of you.
Right, exactly. So, and that I think is part of the invitation of this novel, is like, this is the kid calling everybody a phony inside, who nobody has any real interaction with him throughout the entire novel thus far that we've read. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what I think Salinger is trying to get us to pay attention to if we're willing to go under the surface a little bit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I probably would be like, yes, let's spend more time with him. Now, if I did know the true troubled state of Holden Caulfield's soul, I would have some boundaries for sure. But then I also think, wouldn't I want to be able to love that kind of child, like that boy who's so troubled? Wouldn't I want to be him to be in my house and eating dinner at my table and seeing what a healthy family is and all those kinds of things? So that's a different question. But if I just met Holden, I probably wouldn't be able to see into the troubled state of his soul. Mm.
Tim, how would you respond to Holden? Like, say you're Mr. Spencer, but make him yourself, not that he's kind of a weirdo. So you don't have to actually imagine yourself as him, but like say then Holden's in your class, how would you respond to him? I mean, have you ever had a student that was kind of a Holden Caulfield?
Oh man. Yeah. Well,
has anybody that's a teacher not had a Holden Caulfield?
Exactly.
That might be the better question.
There's a question that I had when I was reading that section, which is, what does Spencer really think about Holden Caulfield? Yeah. And I think that Spencer believes that Holden Caulfield is a promising student. Like, I think that he sees that he's really bright and capable. Otherwise, I don't know that he'd be wasting his time with him. I may be wrong. Maybe Spencer is just kind of like, he's doing his duty, and because he knows that Holden is failing out, he's got to have that conversation with him. But my hunch, based on the kind of interaction about the exam question, is that he sees Holden as having great potential, and he's falling short of that potential. And that's why he's wanted to kind of call him in and have this friendly chat with him. And I also think that Holden likewise sees himself through Spencer's eyes as a boy of promise and disappointment. That's kind of my hunch. I might be reading. Let me pause and say, did you guys read that way?
That Holden sees he sees himself as a disappointment because through Spencer.
Yeah. The key part also though is that Spencer sees him as full of promise. He's not just another kid. He's not just another student. But he's a very promising student.
I think it's meaningful that Holden has a sort of affection for him. He calls him weird in writing about it, but you can tell he has a sort of
respect.
Yeah, I think that's a great word. Respect, love, affection, whatever, for this man, and recognizes that Spencer has taken an interest in him and is grateful for that, you know.
Yeah.
Even if he puts on a facade, you know, that underneath the facade there is a sort of thankfulness for who Spencer, or for what Spencer has done for him.
Yeah.
I completely agree with that.
And Heidi, do you see Spencer? Does Spencer believe that Holden has great potential? He's not just another student.
Yeah, I do think that. And I think he's sick, and I think he messed up the interview. Like, it wasn't what he wanted either.
Yeah.
And yeah. I'm sure you guys have heard this. You know how people say, and I think it's true, that if you read the first book in the Harry Potter series, it's just like the entire series in, like, it's the same trajectory of the entire series, just encapsulated in the first book. And that's true. And I think that this interaction with Spencer is the same thing in this novel. Mm. Like, it's the whole novel, just in, which is this young man who is very promising, who is really smart, who is looking for true human connection, who wants someone to take him under his wing.
Yeah.
And show him how to live in this really confusing world, and then fails to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, can't do it because there's some kind of sickness in Spencer. Mm-hmm. There's a flaw in the system. There's a you know, because this is a book about the systematic loss of innocence to a good person. And that is what happens here. And it's not really Holden's fault. It's not really Spencer's fault. It's systemic, and it's due to some kind of encroaching sickness and illness and disease. And that's what happens in this first interaction. It could have been redemptive, and instead it takes like a downward turn. It's not really anybody's fault. It just happened.
Well, there's that really interesting line where it's at the end of chapter two, he says, "Look, sir, don't worry about me. I mean it. It'll be all right. I'm just going through a phase right now. Everybody goes through phases and all, don't they? And then Spencer says, I don't know, boy. I don't know. And then he says, I hate it when somebody answers that way. Mm-hmm. Sure, sure they do, I said. I mean it, sir. Please don't worry about me. I sort of put my hand on his shoulder. Okay, I said. Wouldn't you like a cup of hot chocolate before you go? Mrs. Spencer would be... And then he makes up a lie and leaves, basically. And that there's so much pathos in that moment, because he's basically so saying, it's okay, don't worry about me. I'm going, it's just a phase. And then he asks, you know, everybody goes through phases and all, don't they? And the longing for the answer that he hopes for in that question is so sad. And then Spencer saying, I don't know, boy, right. I don't know, is both probably true, but also maybe not the answer that he should have given, you know? Right. I don't know how he should have answered it. Because, and he's saying, I don't know if this is really a phase in you. You know, I don't know what's normal for people to go through. And this is an old man saying that, you know, the fact that this old man who's sick and has so much experience with all these kids says that suggests there's a lot more under the surface of that answer, because he's been around kids for years. He's been a teacher. He's experienced. He's lived life, and he doesn't know the answer to the question about whether this is just a phase that all people go through. Mm. And then, you know, Holden goes back to saying, oh, sure, sure they do. He's kind of, he turns it around as if he's trying to encourage them. And then he says, don't worry about me. And then wouldn't you like a cup of hot chocolate? Like he tries to offer him something. Like Spencer doesn't know what to give him. So he says, you know, we'll give you some hot chocolate. We'll give you something pleasant, something warm, you know, that's the best he can do in the moment. And that, yeah. Both very sad and also, as Heidi said, I love that you said it's a microcosm for the whole book, because it does sort of set up the longing and the longing that's in Holden, and the recognition that people aren't able to give him the answers that he wants.
Right. And his own contribution to his feelings of disconnection, and how he deceivingly tries to care for people, but then ends up just alienating himself from any kind of true help, right? Instead of saying to Spencer, like, I'm so lost. I don't know what to do. What could I have done? Help me. Give me some kind of wisdom, right? Instead of that, I'm okay. Just leave me alone. Don't take care of me. And then he lies to him, but he's doing it because he's so lost. And so the thing about Holden, you're right. It's just so terribly sad how he distances himself from everybody, but everybody in the novel does it. If you notice, he only has one-on-one conversations with anybody, and in every single one of them, they always miss each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think if Holden was in my class, I think I would feel, when I've had conversations like this with students, the thing that I just wish that they knew, that just because I'm adult does not mean that I am their judge and jury. And, right. And I think, like, anytime that you're a teacher, or, you know, like a parent, and your kids have friends, it's not a terrible thing, but the student or the kids just view you positionally. They tend to view you positionally first, and as a human being second, because for all of the reasons for all of the accumulated experience of your life, teachers are there to force knowledge into your head, to assess your grades, and to manage your behavior. That's kind of how you view a teacher, right? And there's so many times that I had conversations with students, and I wish that I could just sort of like take that position off, set it aside, and just say, hey, we're just two human beings in this classroom. You can tell me what's going on. because I know there's something going on, you know, and I'm in this moment, I'm not supposed to be your judge. I'm not going to manage your behavior, because it's like it's the thing that can't happen in the scene that we're talking about.
Yeah.
And it's so heartbreaking, because just like you guys are saying, like, if he could just say, Heidi, if he could just say, Mr. Spencer, I failed out. I'm having a terrible time. I'm lost. Yeah. I don't know what to do. I think Mr. Spencer could help him.
Well, right? But the thing is, he probably could, but also, like, I think as adults, as teachers, what happens is, like, so say we say what you're saying that you want to say, that you wish you could say to students, right? Or you wish Spencer could have said to, that I'm here for you, essentially.
Right, right.
It's very difficult for young people, especially, or for all of us, let's be honest, to actually do that asking, right? To actually reach out to the person. Even if you say, you're my good friend. If you say to me, I'm here for you, it's still hard for me to be to sort of be vulnerable enough to go to you if I need something, right? Or if I need, you know. So that's it. And that's exponentially more hard, I think, for students, even if they respect a teacher. Every student's different, of course. Every student-teacher relationship is different. But it's sometimes the ways that they go about doing that reaching out for help often can go unmissed. And I was thinking a lot about, in this book, Holden is constantly trying to literally reach out to people, to literally create contact. Yes. So here he reaches out and touches Spencer's shoulder, right? As it's as if to be encouraging to Spencer. But I think that there's a sort of, he's sort of reaching out for help from Spencer.
For sure.
Spencer doesn't recognize it. Yes, you've got the stuff with his friends where I mentioned they fight earlier. He's sort of like constantly trying to like reach out for help there. And in the end, it leads to a fight. And you'll see it throughout the novel. He tries to reach out for help and people don't recognize that's what he's doing. They recognize it as a threat or something condescending or insulting or something like that. And so he doesn't know how to express his desire to reach out. And then he kind of buries that desire in this sort of immature talk of sex and necking and things like that, which is really just another way of him trying to express this longing to have somebody
connection.
To have connection. Yeah. And he doesn't know how to express that. He doesn't know how to ask, and people aren't recognizing when he is trying to reach out for them. And that's just as sad as his inability to actually ask, is people not recognizing that he is trying or when he's trying.
Right. I completely agree with that. And I think sometimes even Holden himself doesn't know how hard he's trying to reach out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that I think is the purpose of the form of this novel, that it is written in the form of an internal monologue in which we as the readers, we have this position of tragicomic irony in which we, if we're paying attention, we know more about Holden than he knows about himself. Mm. And we are profoundly alienated then from him because we're just the reader. We can't help. I'm a therapist and like a nice person. Like, I just want to like call in this novel and be like, tell me your story.
Well,
and
I'll, you're like, a therapist.
I'll ask questions. Well, right. Exactly. I know. I'm actually, pray for me. So that, like, that is part of, we as the reader are part of the alienation of this, the structure of this novel, which is kind of brilliant. We have access that nobody else has to Holden, and yet we cannot help him. And that, I think, is part of what makes us love or hate this novel.
Mm. There's a dissonance there.
Yes. We're either like, oh, this kid is insufferable, which in some ways he is.
And but like many also, of our students are.
Or yes, our children at home. But that's also very painful for us.
Yeah.
And then, or else, like Jessie, who is a genuinely kind and loving person, she's reading this, and I know Jessie, who's like, I just want to help this boy, right? And you can't. And so it creates, and then you're like, how many other people are like this? And I think that's the question that Salinger is asking, or the invitation that he's giving to the reader is like, this is the universal human experience. Mm.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that the form of the novel does this, because it gives us more. We know him in some ways more than he knows himself.
Yes.
And yet at the same time, part of that dissonance comes from the fact that we don't know when we can trust him.
That's so true.
We don't know when he's talking about himself. Does he know what he's talking about? But even if he doesn't know what he's talking about, we still question whether he knows what he's talking about. And sometimes the only thing that we really can trust is the things that other people say in conversations that he's remembering or recording. And so the question of how reliable he is always under the surface, even as we're trying to, even as we can read between the lines and know more about him than he knows. So it creates, it's a very complicated hierarchy of knowledge of like intimacy, if that makes sense. And,
it totally makes sense.
Because that's all wound together, it creates that dissonance in the reader, which you're talking about, I think. I think all those things are at play that lead to our various responses to it and to him.
Well, and we even ask ourselves, why is he writing this? Which, you know, from the beginning, if you're paying attention, that he's in some kind of sanatorium. He's in, like, he's been sent somewhere to rest. I can't remember how he phrases it, but it's on the, like, the first page of the novel. And he's saying, I'm, you know, he's somewhere.
Yeah, this isn't too far from this crummy place. Oh, he says he's in Hollywood. That isn't too far from this crummy place. And he comes over and visits me practically every weekend.
Right. So he's
going to drive me home.
An asylum. He's having a rest cure. He's, you know, he's been sent away to get better. It's probably, you know, it's like a therapy camp. So, but he still doesn't know himself. He doesn't say anything like, I've learned from my therapy sessions that I'm profoundly grieving for my lost brother and that I am searching for human connection and I can't find it anywhere. You know, so he's still blind. He's revealing himself and yet not to himself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we should probably work towards wrapping this up, but I wanted to go
Seriously?
Back.
We've been talking for like 5 minutes. There's so much more to say.
It's been a solid hour and 10 minutes or something. But we're not going to go quite yet. I'm just saying we need to work towards it. It's a signal to the audience. This isn't going to go on forever.
This is so meta. Thank you for that insight.
So I want to go back to what we were doing there with Peace Like a River for a little while and give you guys each a chance to mention a passage that we didn't get to, but that was meaningful or stood out to you. So Tim, I'll let you do that first. If there's a passage or a line or a conversation or something in these first 9 chapters. And the first episode, of course, there's always a lot of intro stuff and we will hearken back to things that we didn't get to in this section as we read the next 2 sections and then do the Q&A later. But is there anything that you have in mind, Tim?
Sorry, David.
Or should we let Heidi go
something
first?
Yeah, if Heidi's ready. I marked something, I just can't find it.
Well, how about whoever finds it first? Because now I'm
David, do you have something? Sorry, Heidi.
There you go. Deflect to David. It's a good
Well, you were looking first. I want to look at the beginning of chapter 3. There's a passage that he's talking about where he lived in the Ossenberger Memorial Wing. And it starts with, I'm the most terrific liar you ever saw in your life. It's awful. If I'm on my way to the store to buy a magazine even, and somebody asks me where I'm going, I'm liable to say I'm going to the opera. It's terrible. So when I told old Spencer I had to go to the gym to get my equipment and stuff, that was a sheer lie. I don't even keep my bleep equipment in the gym. That little paragraph is really interesting. I think it goes back to some of the point of view stuff that you were talking about, because he is so honest, almost to a fault, like so self-deprecatingly honest, and not in the sense that like, look at me, this is funny about myself, or look at, I look terrible in this shirt, you know, or this photo was bad of me or something like that. He says, I mean, he's being very direct, but it feels like it's understatement, right? Or it feels like it's rhetorical. I'm the most terrific liar you ever saw in your life. It's awful. I mean, he's being honest with us. And that's the ironic thing. And he really might be the most terrific liar you ever saw in your life. And even to say that he's a terrific liar, like he's saying, I'm good at lying. I'm better at lying than anybody. And it's terrible. And he recognizes that it's terrible. But then he also recognizes the skill that he has to do that. And that, I think, sets up a lot of the book, because it sets up the way he interacts with people, the games that he plays, the facade that he puts on, the characters that he puts on, even the chapter in chapter 8 where he meets the woman and says that he meets the who does he say that he's the funny name the Well, there's all these scenes. I'll just put it that way. There's all these scenes where it's constantly telling people that he's somebody else, or making up how he knows them, or whatever. He's playing a character. And, you know, so on the one hand, he's a liar, but on the other hand, he's also an actor. And it gets to something so deep within him early in the novel. But he does it in a way that is so, like, he develops the character, Salinger develops the character so deeply and with so much pathos here in one paragraph that that is so sad, and that I think is worth kind of remembering and keeping front and center. Tim, did you find yours?
Yes. For me, it's page 78. Holden has stepped into a phone booth to call somebody, and he tries to think of various people to call. And
which,
then right,
which
concludes,
chapter is it in? Nine, chapter nine.
Let me see. Beginning of nine. Basically, for me, second page of nine.
Yeah. Okay.
So I ended up not calling anybody. I came out of the booth after about 20 minutes or so, got my bags and walked over to that tunnel where the cabs are and got a cab. I thought he was in the phone booth, not calling anybody for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
He was just in there thinking of who he could call, and he couldn't think of anybody to call. It was just this little, and in the sentence about after 20 minutes or so is buried in the middle of the sentence. It's like he's almost sort of minimizing it even to us. And then you think, you were in there for 20 minutes, you poor kid, trying to think of who to call, and there was nobody to call.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was just going to say jokingly, he needs a social media account because then he'll have all these friends. You know, I was going to say that sarcastically. But then at the same time, this is one of those books that I think shows why young people have invested themselves so deeply.
No doubt.
In TikTok or Instagram or, well, they don't use Facebook anymore, but they did once upon a time. But you know what I'm saying? Like, their lives get wrapped up in those things because then they don't have to stand in the phone booth for 20 minutes and figure out who to call.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a.
Mm-hmm.
This is sad.
It is.
I think it's funny as I'm thinking back about why my friend and I broke up and why this novel was so like a sort of wedge. And I do wonder if he couldn't understand why anybody would devote time to this character. And I couldn't understand how anybody couldn't see this character, like Holden Caulfield, you know? And I'm sure there was some of me identified with Holden Caulfield and I wanted to like be recognized.
Right.
And by having the book not appreciated by my friend, that part of me wasn't being recognized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was your way of reaching out and he wasn't noticing that you were touching him on the shoulder.
And I don't think that I knew that I was reaching out. I mean, I'm sure that I did not ostensibly was like, okay, this is a bid for my friend to see me and I'm sure that did not cross my mind, but on some like lower level. Yeah. I can totally imagine that.
Mm. Heidi, passage.
Yes. Mine's the baseball mitt passage. And for me, it's on page 49. It's like three pages into chapter five.
He's doing the write-up.
He's writing the descriptive essay for Stradlatter, which in itself is a tragic moment, right?
Yeah, why does he do that? That's really so interesting, right? There's no benefit to him to do this for his friend, except that maybe this guy who's not even really his friend will like him.
Well, and to Tim's point, I think if you love this novel and you love this character, it does feel a bit like a rejection to have someone hate him because he is unlikable, and yet he's also just full of this kind of goodness, you know, like he'll write somebody's essay for him that he doesn't even like and gets no benefit from. And it's not just because he's a pushover. It's not just because of that. He is constantly trying to make connections. And I think that moment, and I'm gonna stop here in a minute, but I think the moment when he gets so angry at Ackley for not playing canasta with him is like, that just like broke my heart, because he does so much for this horrible kid who's like, puts his pimply face on his pillowcase and then he won't even get up and play canasta with him, which is a game that Ackley likes. You know, and yeah. It's just so, and it, I mean, Holden doesn't even say he likes it. He just wants to be with somebody. But anyway, so yeah. This part about the baseball mitt. The thing is, I couldn't think of a room or a house or anything to describe the way Stradlatter said he had to have. I'm not too crazy about describing rooms and houses anyway. So what I did, I wrote about my brother Allie's baseball mitt. It was a very descriptive subject. It really was. My brother Allie had this left-handed fielder's mitt. He was left-handed. The thing that was descriptive about it, though, was that he had poems written all over the fingers and the pocket and everywhere in green ink. He wrote them on it so that he'd have something to read when he was in the field and nobody was up at bat. He's dead now. He got leukemia and died when we were up in Maine on July 18th, 1946. You'd have liked him. He was 2 years younger than I was, but he was about 50 times as intelligent. He was terrifically intelligent. His teachers were always writing letters to my mother, telling her what a pleasure it was having a boy like Allie in their class. Then he goes on for a while. I'm going to skip down to the God, he was a nice kid, though. He used to laugh so hard at something he thought of at the dinner table that he just about fell off his chair. I was only 13, and they were going to have me psychoanalyzed and all because I broke all the windows in the garage. I don't blame them. I really don't. I slept in the garage the night he died, and I broke all the GD windows with my fist just for the hell of it. I even tried to break all the windows on the station wagon we had that summer, but my hand was already broken and everything by that time, and I couldn't do it. It was a very stupid thing to do, I'll admit, but I hardly didn't even know I was doing it, and you didn't know, Allie. My hand still hurts me once in a while, and when it rains and all, and I can't make a real fist anymore. Not a tight one, I mean. But outside of that, I don't care much. I mean, I'm not going to be a GD surgeon or a violinist or anything anyway. Anyway, that's what I wrote Stradlatter's composition about, old Allie's baseball mitt. I happened to have it with me in my suitcase, so I got it out and copied down the poems that were written on it. All I had to do was change Allie's name so that nobody would know it was my brother and not Stradlatter's. I wasn't too crazy about doing it, but I couldn't think of anything else descriptive. Besides, I sort of liked writing about it. There's almost like nothing to say about that passage because it's so rich and it's so revealing and compelling and, I mean, just sad. Like, it's like one of the saddest things you've ever read. But and it's also going back to David's point, like the form and the content of this particular novel are so intertwined. Like, he starts talking about the baseball mitt and then he's not talking about the baseball mitt. He's talking about his brother. And then he's not talking about his brother. He's talking about his own grief. And, you know, and then, and it's just this progression into his, but he's not seeing it. He's disconnected completely from himself, and yet it's there, right? It's just coming out of him. And it's also a meta narrative because he's right now writing about it. Like, finally having the chance to tell his story. So I just think this passage is incredibly rich and very, very emotional and moving.
And to offer this as a gift to Stradlatter. And to have Stradlatter reject it.
Yep.
Albeit Stradlatter didn't understand what he was doing, but still he rejects, like, he rejects this. It's so crushing.
Right. It's at the same time so that he's crushing. that Holden thinks that he's dishonoring this girl that Holden
loves. Right.
And that, I mean, no wonder he jumped and tried to punch him in the face, and he even can't do that right. It's just
And the reason that he can't do that right, in part, is he can't make a fist. He can't fight his the loss of his brother and his grief are holding him back from being able to participate in that fight. Like, he can't engage in the fight at full strength because the grief
the
expression
him.
Of the grief has crippled him.
I know. Well, we should silence for Holden.
We should end there, and then we'll have a week of silence.
By the way, I just have to say this. Like, here is a plea. listeners have got to give this book a chance. Got to give this book a chance. I get like all the language and everything that we talked about at the beginning of the show, but yeah, I just think I'm remembering how good this book is.
Well, I'll just remind people after this, we're going to do Anne of Green Gables. So that'll be, if the cynicism in this book is too much for you, then we'll have a few weeks of the earnestness of Anne of Green Gables. So they'll balance each other out. So,
yes.
Yes.
And Anne of Green Gables is also a book that has more going on than it seems like on the surface, I think. So, well, do either of you want to offer any final thoughts before we go?
I feel not me. Like, no.
I just made my plea.
Yep. All right. I agree with it. I do. I have a final thought. Here it is. That I think one of the main results of a true literary life is the development of compassion for characters who are hard to love. Mm. And by extension, then, a posture of humility and compassion towards the people that we encounter in our real life that are difficult to love. And I think that The Catcher in the Rye is a book that offers that invitation and that plea. And I think, as Tim said, we should take it.
It's a training ground. It's not just that. It's pleasurable, but it's a training ground for what you just said, hiding.
Well, I can't add anything to that. That's well said from both of you. So next week we will talk about chapters 10 through 17. And then of course there's also the episode of The Crime and Punishment, the second half of part one. So you can be listening to that and then gearing up for the first half of part two, which we'll do in 2 weeks. And then of course, I wanted to remind you about our friends over at Online Great Books. That's onlinegreatbooks.com/Cersei. You can also enter the code Cersei to get 25% off, or you can just sign up to get their information that they send out about all kinds of great books. So it's a cool resource if you want to participate in that. And with that, I guess that's all. Don't forget about the newsletter, closereads.substack.com. You can follow us on Instagram, on Twitter, @closereadspods. And of course, we hope you'll join the conversation over on the Facebook group. And you can search for that on Facebook if you haven't joined it already. Click that little join button and we will approve you into the group. Last thing before we go, I wanted to let people know that this spring, our literary bracket, which we do each year, is going to be on the great literary romances, the great literary couples. So be on the lookout for that. We're curating a list there now, and we'll be releasing that bracket for you to vote on in early March. So that's the last bit of business I wanted to share with you. But with that, for Heidi White and for Tim McIntosh, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. And until next time, happy reading.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.